Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey everybody, it's the WaitingForNextYear.com podcast. I'm your host, Craig Lindell. On the other end of the line is Andrew. How's it going, sir?
Hey, it's going pretty good.
We maybe talked, what, one or two times in 2018? We can knock that out of the park in the first week of 2019, the first month.
We're doing it.
So where do you want to start first? Do you want to start with the Browns? Everybody loves the Browns.
Might as well. Seems to be a great place to start right now.
So have you heard any of my Freddie Kitchens takes so far?
Have I heard them?
Yeah.
On the podcast?
Yeah. So, well, anyway, I'll give a quick rundown so that we can kind of start there. I like Freddie Kitchens. I think I like the hire, but there's a part of me that has a couple of nervous moments. Number one, I think it feels like John Dorsey hired a guy that he would always win a power struggle over. He kind of maybe even sneakily changed the organizational structure so that the coach reports to him. Nobody's talking about that because people seem to like it. And then there's that, and I think it's kind of a false concept, but there's this idea of, if I told you back when we were watching Hard Knocks that the Cleveland Browns would hire their running backs coach to be their head coach at the end of the season, you'd be like, wait, holy cow. I thought this was going to be one of the most impressive jobs, most attractive jobs in the NFL. And they ended up hiring an incumbent from within who was promoted and wasn't even the interim coach. You got to be kidding me.
Sure. All right. Well, I'll start with the Hard Knocks thing, because it's funny, because I actually just went back last night and watched that scene again. The one when Freddie objected to the guy sitting out and basically said, you know, hey, you know, this doesn't work for me or whatever. And that's when Hugh went into his, it looks different from the seat, blah, blah, blah. And everybody made a big deal out of that. But I went back and I watched that. And it was funny because I remember my impression being the same thing. Like, in that scene, Freddie has a very unimpressive aura. Like, I can't put my finger on it, but he doesn't seem charismatic. He doesn't, and maybe he's not trying to be in that setting, you know, but I remember at the time, like, thinking, like, who is this guy? You know, like, I agreed with him more so probably than Hugh. I hated Hugh's answer to it. Like, I hated the whole, I'm in this chair, you're not, it looks different, blah, blah, blah. But I remembered it at the time. I was like, I don't know. So it is funny, and I think there's something to it, that if at that point in time you told me that guy is going to be the next coach of the Browns, I think I would have been like, oh, I don't know about that. Secondly, I do think it's funny that for all the talk of how this was going to be the job in the NFL, everybody's going to want this job. You know, Bruce Arians expressed interest, but I don't think he got an interview, right? Like, your big name guys didn't get interviews. You know, McCarthy, I don't think he ever interviewed. Gase didn't interview. McDaniels didn't, you know, none of these guys he interviewed. Like, the list of interviews, the people that they interviewed, it was Caldwell was your known guy. And then, and you know, you had Greg Williams and Freddie. And then it was just a bunch of young coordinators. Like
the Patriots defensive coordinator.
Yeah. No, and not even always just coordinators, like position coaches, you know, I mean, which, you know, you could say, well, good for them. They're turning over every stone and trying to find a young, fresh, innovative person rather than maybe a retread. I get that. But I did think it was interesting. I think there's some merit to, for as attractive as this job supposedly was, they didn't hire any of the guys who were, or they didn't talk to any of the guys that were really out there as like the guy, the it guys, you know? So I think there's, I definitely think that's interesting. However, I do feel with Freddie over that, what was it, 8 games? Is that how many, you know, over those 8 games?
The 5-3 Greg Williams era.
Yeah, you know, I do think what we saw with the offense was enough to really pique my interest in, like, okay, he's doing something. I mean, there was a very clear switch that seemed to be flipped. And, I mean, we're talking from the way the offensive line blocked, the way he established the running game, to getting the most out of Baker and putting him in positions to succeed, finding ways to use Jarvis Landry, on and on and on. It seemed like everything he tried seemed to be working. And I think it got to a point where the Browns maybe felt a little bit like, you know, there's something here and we don't want to lose this guy. And if we don't make him our coach, we're going to probably lose him. Like, if in your best case scenario, if you hire whoever it might be, you hire that coach and you say, well, you're going to keep Freddie on as offensive coordinator. Well, you're hoping to have success. And if you have success after that another year of Freddie as an offensive coordinator, he's getting a job somewhere else. And then you have to ask yourself, well, was it really worth not taking the risk on Freddie at that time, you know, just to give him another year of seasoning? So there's a lot of factors that fly around with, in terms of his lack of experience as, you know, a guy being in charge of anything. You know, when you're a position coach, you're not really in charge of a whole lot. I mean, you command your room with your small set of players, but Freddie said it in one of his interviews. He said, you know, the thing he liked when he got to be offensive coordinator was he finally got to speak to the whole offense at once. He had never done that before. And now, you know, he's got to speak to the whole team. And these are things he has not done. So I think it's fair to question it. I have no problem with anybody who questions the hire and says, you know, there's a lot of unknowns to this, and I get that. But I think that there was enough there that there just seemed to be a certain spark, and you can't downplay the relationship with Baker as well. When you see the clips of them messing around on the sidelines with each other and having fun, you can't really downplay that. Baker Mayfield is the most important person to the Browns right now. You know,
Baker Mayfield makes me rethink everything else that I thought I knew about football and the Browns, and every opinion that I've had going back as far as I've been at Waiting for Next Year, and even further than that, is like, we obsessed over all these coaches, and some of them were bad. Like, I don't think Pat Shurmur was going to be good no matter what. I really don't. But Chud, I love Chud. Chud never had the support of the front office. They never got him a quarterback. The infighting, they were never pulling in the same direction. What the Browns have right now is they've got Baker Mayfield, and they are all pulling in the same direction. And whether that's because, or whether that's fostered by John Dorsey hiring a guy and getting the structure of the organization so that the coach reports to him and that they're all on the same page. And I think it's good sometimes to have a boss and make sure that the boss is the boss. And Jimmy Haslam is never going to be a good boss. So in a lot of ways, I can make the argument against myself. I'm just not, I'm not willing to be out there, you know, nuts in the wind, like so many of these other people going, you know, Freddie is my guy. He is my savior. Like, I don't know. I don't know. I think Baker Mayfield makes the margin for error a lot better for any coach, and might as well be Freddie Kitchens, but let's slow down a little bit.
Well, and I think too, like, I'm not trying to be a stick in the mud or anything like that.
I think,
like,
I am.
But I want to push back a little bit on the gets us thing, you know, that we're doing victory laps because of the press conference. And I made the point, like, I'm not a guy that buys into all the press. Like, I've seen some people say, well, we buy into every press conference. And I really don't.
Not anymore.
But I did enjoy his press conference. I did. I
I didn't. But I didn't think he came off that well. I thought he wasn't well spoken. I thought the message was good, but his
introductory press conference, like his prepared remarks, I didn't care for. But I liked his answers to the question.
Fair enough.
But you know, everybody's congratulating themselves because this guy gets us, and they like that he, you know, talks in a certain way.
And if you're not wearing orange and brown, I don't care about you.
You know, and he's calling into the sports talk radio already. Like, I don't know how much I like that, honestly. You know, because you think Bill Belichick's just randomly calling into the sports talk radio guys, you know, and you want to talk about a guy that didn't get us, you know, Bill Belichick didn't get us, but you know, I would take Bill Belichick back in a heartbeat, you know? So I don't know how much value there really is to the guest bus thing. I mean, it's nice and it's fun. It makes it fun to root for him. And
it works really well in January.
Yeah, exactly. And I want Freddie to succeed, obviously, not just because I'm a Browns fan, but I do think he's going to be a fun person to root for when he's having success. But I don't think we're at a point where we need to be saying today, like, yeah, you know, this is the exact type of coach mentality you need in Cleveland. Like, I think we should move past that a little bit. And I want him here because of what he did with the offense, not because he understands the tradition or has the funny little catch sayings or whatever. And you know, I mean, I know, like, we're being, like I said, sticking the mud on this a little bit, but I don't care about that stuff. I want the Browns to be good, and I want to celebrate the Browns for what they're doing on the field. And I want to celebrate the coach because he's innovative and has the team playing together and making smart decisions, managing the clock well, all those things that go into it. Like, that's what I want. I don't care about the gets of stuff so much anymore.
Well, and the other thing about the turnaround that we heard was, and especially I think we heard this from Jarvis Landry, was he was saying that the players, when Hugh Jackson was fired, the coaches rallied around Greg Williams and Greg Williams tried to rally the players, but the players looked around that locker room and decided that they were done with the BS. They were done, and they were going to take a little bit of control and a little bit of ownership. And I think that Freddie Kitchens is a continuation of that. I think it's an environment that was fostered by he and Greg Williams, but ultimately it's all about players. Like, it doesn't matter whether you do have Bill Belichick. Like, if you have the same club that Hugh Jackson was handed, or even the team that Chud was forced to coach, you know, after the Trent Richardson trade, like, it's about players. It's about players and a coach who can mostly stay out of the way enough, not stay out of the way, but stay out of the way of the culture so that the players feel empowered to play hard and rally together as a team.
Yeah, I think you look at a lot of the most successful coaches are guys who get the players to buy in. So I do think that there's a level of that is important. You need the players.
But you're not going to scare players into buying in.
That's right. That's right. But, like, I also think, too, like, I think we kind of talked about this in our Slack channel, this idea of this difference between the coaching decisions that are front-facing and behind the scenes. You know, the things we see as the public are your clock management, some of your strategy and how the matchups you're going with and switching up personnel, things like that. Like, those are the things we can see. It's harder for us to judge the things that go on behind the scenes. And that's where you wonder, I really think, I listen to Joe Thomas's podcast a lot, The Tomahawk, and because it's so interesting to me, because they've sort of turned all of these ideas I've held for a long time about what mattered to players and what's important. And, you know, I always thought, like, motivation was a big thing for whatever reason. Like, I've always thought, like, you really wanted a coach that was inspiring and could get the guys excited to play. And, both Joe Thomas and Andrew Hawkins kind of said, that might work your first year or two, but a few years in, like, that's not working for you. Like, that's nothing to those
guys. And they said, like, guys like Ray Lewis, their teammates end up feeling like they're corny. Between that and Tony Dungy saying that, like, even the best coaches can only really get that extra oomph out of their team, like, maybe 2 to 4 times a year. Other than that, you just can't do it every week. It wears thin.
Yeah. And so I think it just comes down to, just coming out every week with a good game plan. You keep talking about Belichick, but, Belichick is a guy that has the ultimate preparation every week. He's not giving it rah-rah speeches and things like that. It's just, here's the information. Here's how we're going to match up against these guys. We're going to practice. We're going to run through all these different scenarios, and we're going to have every corner looked at. Like, if they do this, this is how we're going to react. They do that, but it's not so much about rallying the troops or whatever. Like, at a certain degree, when you get to the NFL, you need those players to sort of take that upon themselves. And I think that's why it was encouraging that the players did that. Jarvis Landry said, we looked at each other in the locker room and said, enough's enough. Like, we have to put an end to this. And I think that's something we've been waiting for as fans for a long time. We've cycled through the coaches, the general managers, the presidents, on and on and on, all the changes the Browns have made, since they've returned. you know, the one thing is it felt like the players were never galvanized in that changing of the culture. And I think that's where a guy like Jarvis Landry has been huge for this team. I mean, putting aside any performance or anything like that, just that ability to, and I'm not just talking about the Hard Knocks thing, because I think that maybe was blown out of proportion a little bit, but he's brought this idea of enough's enough. You know, it doesn't matter what's happened in the past. And, you know, and Baker obviously is a guy that fits right into that, but he's come in and said, enough's enough.
And we also learned something from Jarvis Landry and Hard Knocks this year. And it's that, like, just because you bring in a guy who has that drive, has that fire and that professionalism about practice, doesn't mean that he's going to naturally turn every Corey Coleman into a useful player. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I still thought they just gave that guy away for nothing.
It sure felt that way at the time, but
turns out it was no big deal.
Yep. where did I just see him the other day? He was in the playoffs, right? Wasn't he on the playoff team?
I don't know.
I think he's like a punt returner or something.
How embarrassing for him.
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up.
Okay.
Let's see. It says current team he's with the New York Giants. It must have been one of those final week games.
No, it was the Giants Cowboys. They played that last week of the regular season. That's which game it was that I watched. Yeah, because I heard the name Corey Coleman, and I did like a – at first it was like a, wait, I know that name. Who is that? And it was like, oh, my God, that's right. Like the Browns just released him.
Well, I've heard he's got a New York essence.
Yeah, exactly. So good for him.
But other than my nitpicking – I'm really excited. I mean, I'm obviously very excited. This is the first time in years I've been able to buy Browns gear. I almost said Manziel. That's crazy. Double Mayfield jerseys for Christmas for my boys. And, it's the first time I was proud to buy jerseys in a long time.
Yeah. I mean, this season was awesome. I mean, I've never had more fun with a 7-8-1 season, you know, it's hard to maybe for a lot of people to understand outside of Cleveland, but like when you've had, because I don't know too many franchises that have gone through the extended period of losing that the Browns have gone through, and the pain of the 0-16 season, and to turn around this year and be fighting for the playoffs down to the last game of the season, it was just awesome. It was so much fun, and there's such an energy with the team, and again, you can't down or overstate enough, I guess, what having a guy like Baker Mayfield means, having that quarterback. Like, we are going into a draft where we don't have to think about the quarterback at all. Like, it doesn't matter in this draft. And
now's when you trade down. Now.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a certain excitement in that's really tangible, that's really kind of carrying over, because it's like, okay, so we're happy, we're confident in Baker, but beyond that, I mean,
how confident did the Patriots go into every draft once they identified Tom Brady as their starting quarterback?
Well, yeah, exactly. And you know, when you don't have to worry about that position, everything else can just kind of fall into place. And even beyond Baker, when you're looking at the offense, you know, having Nick Chubb and finding out like, okay, so we've got a running back, you know, and Duke. Okay, great. So, you know, running backs are looking pretty good. You know, we still got Jarvis. Callaway showed some things. You know, I wouldn't mind another receiver coming in, but I'm just saying, like, there's pieces here. Like, there's things where you can kind of say these positions can kind of take care of themselves. And if we can add a piece here or there, that's cool. But for the most part, like, we can really hone in on these are the areas that we need to address, you know, whether that might be left tackle if they don't keep Robinson, or, you know, or if you want certain spots on the defense, whatever they want to do. But you can really narrow in on those spots to improve your team. And that's so huge for stabilizing your roster turnover.
And we've got John Dorsey, who seems to be capable of identifying players later in the draft who can be useful. it's been so long since Browns fans have been able to count on that at all and not having to worry about a guy like Jeremiah Farms who's going to get arrested in Oregon. Or, I mean, it just, the amount or a second round like Mangini had where three players were basically should have been out of the league within 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Or hell, we could go all the way back to, Sean Thompson?
With a C. Linebacker. Yeah, Butch Davis. It was like a Division II.
Yeah. I mean, that's a second round pick. It was a second round pick that was graded as a very late draft pick, and they took him in the second round. Like,
and he was a physical freak, like jump out of the gym, run faster than anybody, lift more than anybody. But like, that's not what playing football is all about.
No. And so like, it's just been such an ongoing long-term problem.
That, yeah.
You know, you can laugh, like you can just go back and look, pull up Pro Football Reference and go through the Browns draft year by year and just look at them and look at how many guys just not only like weren't roster guys, like they were just out of the league. I mean, it's that's how you run a football franchise.
How happy are you that the Sashi wars are over?
Oh, thank God. I mean, it's just to see John Dorsey, and John Dorsey isn't infallible, you know. I mean, this is a guy who just let go of a job in Kansas City a couple years ago, a Kansas City team that's, yes, he helped build, but there's a reason he was let go, right? So I'm not going to sit here and say he's infallible, but it really feels like he's exactly what the Browns needed. Like, maybe he wasn't the right fit for Kansas City anymore, but I think he brings something to the Browns that had been lacking for so long. And his ability to the thing that I really noticed the most about Dorsey compared to so many of these previous regimes that we've had is, I don't want to say a lack of ego, because I think John Dorsey has ego, but I think it's a willingness to collaborate. He seems to value a little bit of a more open flow of ideas, and he's really built out the top end of that front office. You know, these guys that they've brought in, Highsmith, Wolf, you know, keeping Dee Podesta there, you know, like on and on and on. Like, it's a very highly respected group of people that all have voices in this organization. And we haven't really had that. I mean, you know, because again, I mean, we can go back to the power struggles we've had over the years, you know. I mean, Mangini and what was the president or GM or whatever that was here with Mangini, I can't believe I forgot.
Oh yeah, it's on the tip of my tongue.
George Kokinas, you know, you had that power struggle. Years and year after year. And
wait, who was it?
George Kokinas.
my new device has sounds built in.
You were just waiting to play with that.
And who's the Browns' new president or GM?
John Dorsey. Wow, the crowd loves it.
And what's the Cavaliers' record?
I don't want to talk about it.
This thing is so cheesy.
I just said Cavaliers and then played it.
I can't tell you how cheesy the soundboard thing is.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But it's fun.
Yes.
But no, I mean, I was just saying, like, you know, we've seen so many power struggles over the years with, you know, the Browns front office. And that's not to say it won't happen at some point down the road here, but I just think the fit for where the Browns are, to bring in a guy who's good at identifying players in the draft. He had a very strong idea of what he wanted to do with free agency and trades last year. You know, he set the roster up in a place where this looks like an NFL roster. It doesn't look like I don't think it's quite a top end roster yet. We hope that we can get there, but you know, he's built a roster. There seems to be a cohesiveness going throughout the franchise. Everybody seems to be on the same page, pulling the same direction. And it feels good.
All right, let's move on. Let's talk about those Cavaliers. I don't even know what to say about them anymore. This is the state of the NBA. I mean, and nobody feels sorry for us. The Cavaliers won a championship. We had LeBron James for the better part of his entire career, it looks like. And It's hard, but you go from being the top team to being completely and utterly irrelevant with no tangible path back to relevancy.
Irrelevant's not even the right word for it. I mean, they're something below irrelevant. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're disastrous. I mean, they really are. And, you know, it was funny because, you know,
and they have been every single time LeBron James hasn't been on this roster.
Yeah. And, you know, it was just funny because so going into the year, Nam had the idea that we were going to do the wins and lessons. You know, that was Ty Lue's catchphrase. You know, this season was going to be about wins and lessons. And we were like, you know what, let's riff on that. And, you know, this will be really fun this year to really chart the progress they make. We'll talk about the lessons that they're learning.
How about all those people who are like, you know what, I'm really kind of looking forward to seeing the young guns play and seeing how they develop. How are those people feeling today?
Oh, and it's funny. Like, I haven't talked to Nam about this in a couple of weeks, so I don't know where his head's at today on it. But, like, I'm sitting there, I'm like, I can't write these pieces because I don't know what to say about it. Like, there's nothing constructive happening right now.
It's like when we used to do the Browns will win if. Prior to games that were coached by Pat Shurmur. It's like, dude, those were the Browns teams that were like narrowly defeating the worst Seahawks teams in the history of the world, 6-4 or whatever.
Yeah. And I remember we did. That's basically what happened with that series is we got to the point where like, we can't write this anymore. Like there's no usefulness in this, in what's happening. And that's where we're at with the Cavs. Like, There's nothing to be deciphered anymore at this point. Like
even the trade deadline's not interesting.
No, and I think that there will be some people who will say this is just a necessary part of the process, but this is good, that the Cavs are ahead of schedule. Like the Cavs wanted to postpone this, burn it all down, and this is happening faster than expected. And I get that. I'm not saying that this is necessarily something that will be a long-term stain on the franchise, but it's alarming that we're really repeating the past year. You know, in terms of the first time LeBron left, there was a lot of talk that this team's going to still compete for the playoffs, right? Like, we still have Mo Williams, we still have Antoine Jameson, we still have Zydrunas Ilgauskas,
Jamario Moon.
Yeah, Jamario Moon was a part of those teams, you know, and I just remember it. Like there was all this talk. Booby Gibson was still playing at that point, you know, and there was all this talk that they were going to still fight for the playoffs. And that was on the bravado of Dan Gilbert. I guarantee we'll win a championship before LeBron. And then that season happened, you know, and you set the record, the losing streak record, and it was awful. It was really hard to go through. And what bothers me is that, once again, the Cavs lost LeBron, and they went through the same spiel. And they even went so far as to tell Kevin Love, we're not rebuilding, and let's come to a long-term contract. And Love says, okay, I'm in. And we find out that there was an agreement that if LeBron left, they would trade Kyle Korver. And they told him, we're not trading you. Like, we need you to be a part of this team. We're building something. We want this continuity. This is going to be a continuation. We may not contend for championships. We're going to make the playoffs. We've got a culture here we want to keep. And there was all this talk. And after two games, they put an end to it. And they told Ty Lue, stop playing these veterans. They told a guy like Kyle Korver, who you promised you would trade and wouldn't do it then, and told him he had to play here, and now you're telling Ty Lue he can't play him, and J.R. Smith, and, you know, and then, you know, you get the Kevin Love injury that certainly did not help matters at all, and all of a sudden, like, we're right back to cycling in guys on 10-day contracts and picking up guys here and there, and guys who have no
business. Jawad Williams.
It's the Jawad Williams thing all over again, and the Samardo Samuels and Alonzo Gee, you know, and like on and on and on.
Who was the other tall guy? It's basically Zizic.
Yeah.
There's a big white dude from Notre Dame, right?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm drawing a blank. But yeah, I mean, but that it was just this on Herengody, Luke Herengody.
Thank you. I mean, I should never say thank you for Luke Herengody.
Yeah. So it's like we're right back in it, and it's tough because if there, I would have felt so much better about it if the Cavs would have just said, "This is what we're doing. We're rebuilding. Like LeBron's gone. We're going to put an end to this. You trade those guys in the offseason. You get rid of J.R. Smith. You don't let him become a distraction. You trade Kyle Korver as you promised. You talk to Kevin Love and you say, this is what we're doing. If you want to sign here and stay, you can. But if not, we'll go our separate ways as well. We'll trade you or whatever. I mean, I would have felt so much better about this if this was the plan. And what bothers me about it is this was not the plan. This is a disastrous season. And I just fear,
Do you think they planned on this happening this way kind of all along? Or do you think they really meant to compete and it hit the shitter?
I think that they thought that they were going to compete. And I think when they saw the way those first two games happened and they said, oh gosh, like, I don't think we're a playoff team. And I think at that point, Kobe Altman, who I think is, the nicest way I can say, I mean, he's inexperienced, and I think he kind of freaked out a little bit. And I think they kind of said, oh my gosh, like, we're not a playoff team. We need to do something. Like, okay, let's rebuild now. Let's stop playing the veterans. And you don't think about the way that's going to impact the veterans.
And thanks to Dan Gilbert, we've got a beginner executive, right. Beginner GM.
Yeah, exactly. And it's tough because, and I even remember.
You want to talk about power dynamics and how, John Dorsey kind of secretly installed a coach that he had power over. That's what Dan Gilbert did with Kobe Altman, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
I'm going to take control of my team again. Blah, 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 blah.
And that's kind of what happened with Chris Grant a little bit, too, when, Danny Ferry, kind of got to the point where they weren't really seeing eye to eye. And it was like, okay, we need to move on. And then there was all this talk. I'm going to bring in Tom Izzo as the president. And, there was all these theories and different guys that we were going to bring in. And then he just hires Chris Grant, right? And I liked Chris Grant personally. I think he really tried to do a lot of good things for the Cavs. And he was great at gathering assets. Like, there's no doubt about it. But I just feel like we're going through that same cycle here again, where you have David Griffin come in and you get to the point where he and Dan aren't seeing eye to eye and Griff has to go. And then you say, oh, we're going to bring in Chauncey Billups. That was the big thing. He's still talking to Tom Izzo. And you still heard that name thrown out there. And you just get to the point where Dan Gilbert says he's going to bring in these guys. And then he just hires somebody that it feels like a crony move a little bit. And that may not be fair to Kobe Altman, because I think Kobe seems like a good guy, and I think he's very smart and well-respected in terms of, if you listen to David Griffin talk about him, Griff thinks the world of him, So I'm not saying he's incapable of doing his job, but I go back to even when Richard Jefferson talked about after he got traded a couple years ago, and he talked about how he didn't really like the way Kobe handled it. I mean, he mentioned it. He said, Kobe, he would try to figure out what was going on, and Kobe would just say, oh, nothing's going on, or wouldn't talk to him. And he felt very out of the loop, and he didn't think that was the right way to handle it. And those are the things when you're a young GM, you may not understand that. Like, figuring out the best move for the team is one thing, but you need to be respectful to the veteran players as well, because these guys all talk around the league too. And if you want to be able to sign free agents at some point, how does it look when you're going to, when it comes out publicly what they did with Kyle Korver? Like, that just really, really bothers me, that I'm worried that we're not handling guys the right way. And even the J.R. Smith thing, like, I don't know how well that was really handled. And I'm not saying J.R. was in the right either.
Well, and I hate to always compare this to Brown stuff, but it was like when, I get cutting ties with Paul Kruger, but when everybody in the Browns locker room is going, oh man, you did that guy dirty, or the way they cut Joe Hayden, it's not as simple as whether a guy's useful or worth his salary. It's about doing things in such a way that you can hold your head high. Like, the Browns, The Browns complimented Greg Williams like crazy on his way out the door, even though they didn't choose him. Nobody buried that guy, you know? Even the way they handled the firing of Hugh Jackson, like, I didn't feel like they did anything wrong. And I thought they handled themselves with class. And when you feel like your favorite basketball team is making newbie-style mistakes, it's just – it's frustrating because they just had LeBron. Yep. They just won a championship. They should have some of that DNA in that front office, and they cut it all loose. It's not just the players. They've got none of that leadership that brought that championship to Cleveland.
Yeah. I mean, that championship was in 2016. 2016. We were celebrating, and, you know, it's so weird that – because last season was a tough season. It wasn't a fun season. I don't think anybody thought it was fun in the wake of the Kyrie stuff. And, you know, that was – it was a tough year. So I don't want to say, like, oh, just last year we were still fighting for the championship, because last year wasn't fun either. But it's just crazy to look at what we had in 2016 and we – you know, going back and to even 2017, like the joy of that season as defending champions, and how quickly you look around and like we're down to Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson, you know, like that's all we have left. So,
and Tristan's been a shell of himself for like 2 years now.
Yeah. I mean, he was having a great year this year. I mean, prior to his injury, but like, it's just so surreal to me, like how quickly, you know, all of this has just come tumbling down, and it's just jarring. And I don't feel a sense of confidence that there's a real strong plan in place for turning this around. Like they're going to fall ass backwards into a top three pick, you know, that's great.
But there is no plan. You're right.
But what's the plan? Like that, I just don't feel good about it. And I think that's what's really frustrating, because you can, like I said, you can lose a guy like LeBron and you can say we have to rebuild and handle it in a way in which it feels like you were in control of the situation. Like you know, you can always control the things you can control, and you can't control if LeBron wants to go play for Los Angeles. You can't control that. So I don't blame Kobe Altman for that. I don't blame Kobe for Kyrie wanting out or anything like that. Like, but I just don't know that I see the vision for where they're moving. I don't know what direction anything is going in. And that's why it's been so painfully hard to write about this Cavs team this year, because what are you supposed to say?
Well, and that's a perfect place for us to finish up with the Tribe. And you're not like, I almost feel like I need to apologize for Tribe Talk when it's me and you.
Yeah.
Cause like I couldn't name the top five prospects in the Indians farm system. And there's so many people who know so much more than we do, but I still feel like my perspective is somewhat valuable, because in some ways I understand the Indians off season completely and totally. I would have been really disappointed and upset if they just kind of rolled back the same team. I feel like trading Encarnacion, even though it's a salary dump, is probably a positive move and one of the few places where they needed or could make a change. And I also feel like they've given themselves flexibility to really attack the trade deadline this year. But I also feel like they're in a World Series contention window, and they're going to start the season worse than they finished, at least on paper.
Yeah, I think that's where I settle in on this is they're on the tail end of this window, but this is still their window. Like, you're in a division that they should win. Like, you know, I mean, you know, injuries can always change anything or, you know, whatever, but they should win this division. And you win that division, you get in the postseason, anything can happen. And to me, it doesn't feel like they're doing things to even to just sustain this window. Like, it feels almost sort of like they're just trying to set the stage to shut this window. And that's what's been frustrating. I don't feel any sense of urgency with them. And again, you know, you can talk about like the Corey Kluber stuff. Like, I don't want them to make a trade just to make a trade, like to say, like, oh, we need to do something, let's make the trade. So good for them. If they're not getting good return on any of these offers, like, you know, don't trade him just because, you know, you got to get the right trade. So I'm not saying that, but it just, I just haven't seen any kind of urgency with them. Like, if they, other than the Encarnacion trade, like, I don't, have they even made any other moves? Like, I mean, it's been so quiet.
Yeah, you know, they Carlos Santana comes back, Encarnacion goes out. They got Bowers, the outfielder. I guess a couple small bullpen moves, but no, for the most part, all we've seen are departing players and that one and Encarnacion.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know, like, you know, you lose a guy like Andrew Miller, and Andrew Miller wasn't the same guy the last couple years, so. I don't know what the impact of that is, but you lose him, you lose Michael Brantley. You know, these are just guys who are important parts of the team, and I don't know what they're replacing them with. And I think that's what's frustrating to a casual fan like myself. Like, you know, I can't sit here and see the bigger picture necessarily. And so that's where I'm kind of with you. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say I have all the answers. I can only speak as an uneducated fan, but this has not been the kind of off season that's given me any kind of hope or inspiration for this upcoming season.
Well, and anytime the Indians do anything that's questionable from a business standpoint, it always comes back to the fact that whether or not you subscribe to the Dolans are cheap kind of a thing, the fact is they're not one of those funny money billionaire, multi-billionaire ownership groups. And as we see baseball teams skyrocket in value and we see TV money continue to rise and overtake attendance money and all the old ways of making money, the idea that the Indians are still maybe one hand tied behind their back compared to the rest of the majors, it's the most frustrating thing in the world. Nobody for a second thinks that the Browns won't be able to pay Baker Mayfield. Nobody for a second thought that Dan Gilbert wouldn't be able to afford LeBron James. But here we are. And I think that's the uphill battle that the Indians have faced ever since the 90s ended, those 90s runs ended.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's been so hard for me to embrace a guy like Francisco Lindor when you really are just waiting for, like,
and by the way, some of these younger fans and some of the younger writers that we deal with, if they weren't of an age where they could really emotionally get crushed by Manny Ramirez leaving and then Jim Thome leaving, I mean, those were my formative years as a sports fan, not in the way like the Browns were formative for me when I was 7 and 8, but like when I was old enough to really kind of understand the way things were going and to watch Jeff Morad take Manny Ramirez out of town for $20 million a year or whatever it turned out to be when the Indians were offering between $16 and $18 million a year. That was my awakening. That was my coming of age.
Yeah. I still remember, you know, when Albert Bell happened, it was like, man, screw that guy, right? Like, I can't believe he would go somewhere else. And then when the Manny thing happened, it was like, man, like, what's going on here? Like, I can't believe Manny left, you know, and screw that agent, right?
And I think that was like 98 or 99. And then that was the first time where we were looking for signs that the player was unhappy in his new spot and he didn't know how good he had it in Cleveland, like that. And that was true. Manny was miserable in Boston for the first couple of years because the Indians let him kind of be himself and let him get away with all the stuff. And he had none of that superstar pressure. And then he went to Boston. He was under a microscope.
Yep. And then it was like, and then, you know, Jim Thome happens and all of a sudden you're like, well, okay. So there's this trend here. Like, these teams that meant something very real to people our age.
And even when the Indians got smart, they traded back-to-back Cy Young Award winners.
Yeah, and it's just like there's this continuing idea from that began with this team that meant so much to us, and all of a sudden, guys started leaving. and some of them left through free agency. And to your point, then they started trading guys when they were at the end of their contract. And, you know, it really all came crashing down with Victor Martinez. I mean, that was just the ultimate. And there could not be a more damning thing to a fan base than the footage they had of Victor crying at his locker and kid at saying, are we still Indians? You know, like, that was crushing to that sports fan's soul, you know. And I'm not saying that it wasn't, maybe that was the right thing to do for the team. Like, the Indians to play on the uneven playing ground that they're forced to play in, maybe that's what they have to do. And maybe that's really smart. Like, everybody seems to really like and respect the Indians front office. They've managed to keep the Indians mostly relevant for a very long time. And these are all impressive things, but it's just hard as a casual fan, like myself, somebody who's not inclined to just watch baseball. It's hard to sit here and get emotionally invested in Francisco Lindor knowing he's going to be gone in a couple of years. Like, that's been really hard. And to see them not really taking advantage of it in this window really sucks, because I almost feel like it's making me prepare even earlier to lose Lindor. Like, it seems like they're just already throwing the white flag to a certain degree.
Which is part of the reason why I was happy they traded Encarnacion and they decided to turn over the roster. And, oh, Yan Gomes. They traded Yan Gomes, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But I was happy, because if the Indians are truly going to be competitive in the next phase and extend this window, they're going to do it with players that I don't know their name right now, that are going to come up from the minors and be, if not the next Manny Ramirez, maybe the next Jose Ramirez, or even the next Kipnis. Because if a young Jason Kipnis showed up out of the minors this year, it could very well be the kind of player that would put them over the top, because the Indians just need to get incrementally better. And they were getting incrementally worse since their World Series appearance.
Well, I'm going to make a joke. Maybe that guy could be Yandy Diaz. Like, oh, wait. I don't know. Like, I can't sit here and say I have any answers or anything like that, because I don't follow the sport closely enough. But I certainly, the people that you and I really respect, that we have the luxury of watching them talk baseball all day in our Slack channel, like, they're concerned, and that really scares me. You know, like, if these guys are concerned, like, okay, I'm not just being a dumb fan on this. Like, you know, there's some real frustration and things that aren't working out the way I think a lot of us hope they would. So I don't know. We'll have to see, but it doesn't feel great.
All right, man. I think that's a good place to stop.
All right.
You and I can chew up 47 minutes like nobody's business.
Indeed.
All right, man. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next time. It's been the WaitingForNextYear.com podcast.
What was it like to be there for historical sports moments and unforgettable performances? To be behind the scenes? On PressBox Access, you'll hear from me, Todd Jones, and other sports writers about their experiences with the greatest athletes, coaches, and sports events of the past half century. We'll share some stories behind the stories, some big, some small, and some we've only told each other. Let us buy you a round on PressBox Access.